group. So there you go.
Welcome. So it's not.
Hello.
There you are. Good evening. How are you, Abdullah?
Good. How's it going?
Yeah, good, man. Good to have you on. Thank you so much. I know you've only got an hour with you. It was more of an open topic, but there were a couple of things that caught my attention. Obviously, I have my two panelists, so I'm sure we could easily spend an hour and longer with you and get your thoughts on some things. But before we do, how are you, sir? Are you well? Anything to tell us?
I'm good. Thank you. How is the sound quality? Is it okay?
Yeah, you're coming through well. Are you on computer or your phone?
I'm on my phone with a new headset, so I just wasn't sure of the quality. Okay, it's good. That's wonderful to hear.
No, you're coming through clearly. Any news on your side? Have you had anything that, obviously, we don't hear that much from Canada? So is there any interesting news, you know, from your side that you'd share with us before we get going?
No, I don't have any updates from my end, actually. Not really.
Okay, that's unusual. Hopefully a good thing.
I've just been busy with work and stuff and kind of had my head down and not really paying much attention, I guess, to what's going on in the world.
Sometimes that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yes, so, it is.
Cool. Well, thank you so much again for coming on. There was something that caught my attention in Speaker's Corner recently, and I wanted to get your view on it. And obviously, we'll get Abu and Stops's view as well. There was a particular Muslim in Speaker's Corner. I'm looking for the video. I can't play it with sound anyway. I've got a fiddle to get sound working. But there was a view here by what I think a lot of Muslims would consider a reasonably intelligent Muslim. He's a convert here in the UK. And his view was that Muhammad has never ordered or taken the life of any innocent man, woman, child, priest, etc., etc. And I was wondering what your thoughts, and I know there's going to be a few things there, I wondered what your thoughts were on that claim that Muhammad has never done it to, quote, innocent people. He didn't mention men, obviously, but no women, children, priests, etc.
Right. So there's quite a few, actually, people that he would have killed that I would have considered unjust. There's a page called Wiki Islam, which was made by ex-Muslims. And on Wiki Islam, if you look up list of deaths ordered by Muhammad, there's a whole bunch of them. And some of them include slave girls. So the slave girl one is the most troubling to me because, you know, they're not really in charge of their own autonomy. They're pretty much doing what they're told to do, you know. So these slave girls, apparently they made some poetry against the Prophet. And so I guess they were ordered to be killed. And I'm not sure if both of them were killed. The one was killed and one was forgiven or something, or she repented. There's other examples as well. But whenever you bring up any sort of examples like this, it's always disputed. Like the other example is Ka'b ibn Ashraf. So the story of Ka'b goes as follows. Like this guy, supposedly he was half Jewish, half Arab. And he was a very good looking guy and he was very popular. And he was writing poetry against the Prophet. And so Muhammad asked his companions, he said, who will get rid of this enemy of Allah, or you know, something like that, for me, right? So one of his companions came up to him and said, I'll do it, but will you permit us to lie, like to deceive, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, go ahead, you can lie. So then, you know, they went up to this guy and they told him, you know, come, you know, we are your old friends. And we just want to see you. It's been a long time, you know, good old buddies, you know. And he was nervous, but he came out and they killed him. And that was the end of Ka'b ibn Ashraf. Now, Muslims will justify and they say, well, he was making poetry against Muslim women. So he was insulting Muslim women and saying this one is a, you know, a slut or something. And I don't know, like basically they justify it. They justify the use of this political assassination on the grounds that he was making some sort of poetry. So I don't know what you think about that, but I don't see how making poetry, and then they'll also say that, oh, he was instigating war against the Muslims. So, you know, whatever example you give, it's kind of like, oh, but this and but that. And so I don't really get into examples like that, but I do like the example. I mean, I don't like the example of him killing slave girls. That just seems like there's almost no reason you should ever do that because they're slaves, right? They're just doing what they're told to do. So it doesn't make sense to kill a slave girl. And there's other examples as well. For example, was it the foster brother of Uthman, and his name was Abdullah ibn Abi Sarr. Abdullah ibn Abi Sarr was one of the people that Prophet Muhammad said, if you find him, kill him, even if he's holding on to the cloth of the Kaaba. So the Kaaba, which is this ancient house of, you know, idolatry, now monotheism, is known as, you know, the most sacred place in the world to the Arabs, the pre-Islamic Arabs and the Muslims.
Yeah.
So this is like the holy, the sanctified ground. Even the word Masjid al-Haram or Masjid al-Haram, it means forbidden. It's like sacred, right? So even in this place, he said, even if they're holding on to the cloth of the Kaaba, like kill him, right? Like that's what he was saying, right? And because these guys are enemies of Allah, supposedly. So whatever the pre-Islamic values they had, even the good ones, they would just throw them out the window when it came to Muhammad and his deciding arbitrarily what was, you know, what was now the new law, right? So a lot of these pre-Islamic values were just thrown out the window because he deemed it now that this is now appropriate to kill. So anyway, so this guy, Abdullah ibn Abi Sarr, he ran away, and he was one of the people that used to write the revelation of Muhammad. So he used to write the revelation of Muhammad, and according to the story, he apostated because when he was writing the story says that he was writing Muhammad's revelation from God, and then this guy said, like, one of, you know, a lot of the verses in the Quran end with like As-Sami'ul Alim, like, you know, the one that hears everything and knows everything, or Arhamur Rahim, you know, one of the names and attributes of Allah. So Muhammad mentioned, you know, whatever the attribute was, like Al-Wahid or Al-Qahar or whatever, and then Abdullah was like, well, actually, it sounds, maybe it should be more like, you know, and he mentioned another name of Allah, like the great Al-Aziz Al-Hakim or something, right? The great and mighty. So then Muhammad said, so write that instead. So he did, and then he's like, whoa, either I'm a prophet or he's not a prophet. Which one is it, right? So he apostated from Islam, and he was one of the ones that Muhammad said, kill him no matter what. Right, like, just this guy cannot be forgiven, right? So what ended up happening, sorry, I'm going on and on, I'll just finish my story quickly. So what ended up happening with Abdullah ibn Abi Sarr is he ran away and he hid his face, and then he came back with Uthman, because Uthman was the beloved, he was very close to Muhammad because he helped Muhammad a lot. He donated, like, he was like a millionaire in today's terms, according to the official story, and he donated like caravans and caravans and caravans of wealth to Muhammad to fight his jihad, right? To fight his battles.
Yeah.
So he was considered like one of the 10 Mubashirin, Ashar al-Mubashirin, the one of the 10 promised paradise by Muhammad, well, by Allah, I guess, but through Muhammad. So this guy, this was his foster brother. So they were like tight. So he came up, you know, he uncovered his face right in front of Muhammad, and he's like, you know, I bear witness there's no God but Allah. And Muhammad, by Muhammad's own laws, they cannot kill anyone that accepts Islam. So, and the Prophet, and he asked the Prophet to give him his allegiance, right? And Muhammad was just standing there, and he didn't do anything. And so then it's like now awkward, right? Like what's going to happen? The guy's like, there's a death warrant on his head, yet, you know, he's standing there and nobody's doing anything. So he said it again, and then eventually Muhammad accepted him and said, okay, fine, right? Now the funny thing is, after he left, listen to this. This is hilarious. Muhammad asked his companions, why didn't you guys kill him? Like, that's what he asked them, right? And yeah, they're like, why didn't we kill him? Like, why didn't you, like, wink with your eyes, right? Like, you know, wink, wink, you know, stab him in the back, right? Like that, right? Oh, no, no, not befitting for a prophet to wink to kill people. So it's not befitting to, you know, wink, wink, stab him in the back. That's not appropriate for a prophet, but, like, you know, sending assassins in the middle of the night to lie to people and murder them, that's okay. So anyways, that's just some examples. I went on for a little bit too long, so that's the stories.
Yes, I've got the link open. I've posted it in our chat here and also
awesome.
In the main chat. And it shows up to 43 now. That's probably different instances, but there may be more than one person involved having a look there.
Yeah, some of them are maybe disputed, and, you know, there's different things. But, I mean, it's a pretty big list. So if you don't like one of the examples, like, you know, some people have told me, like, the first one on the list is disputed by, you know, scholars or whatever, because there's multiple narrations and one narration has this and the other narration has that. So if someone doesn't like one example, okay, fine, there's another 42 examples. Just carry on, there's lots of them.
Yeah, so I guess the main point is that he wasn't a completely passive and innocent guy, even when people weren't attacking. But that's what I hear a lot. I always hear Muslims going, no, the only time you can take a life is when you're attacking. But it's easy to make up that you're being attacked. It could be that you're being attacked verbally or psychologically. It's not necessarily somebody's got a sword ready to kill you, is it? So that's another
thing. Right. Can I add one more example? So I have one more example, actually, that just came to mind, which is the dying wish of Muhammad was to send Osama bin Zayd. Osama was his beloved grandson, and Zayd is, you know, his son, his adopted son that he married his wife. So this is his grandson, Osama, who he loved. His dying wish was to send Osama bin Zayd to fight the Romans. So this was like an offensive jihad. This isn't like a defensive jihad, right? And I mean, you can argue it was, you know, proactive, you know, so they wouldn't be attacked back or something. Or, you know, there's some history behind why he did that. But clearly Islam is not a pacifist religion. The whole point of the jihad was to increase the borders, convert more people to Islam. I mean, the whole point of jihad, if you read what the scholars say, is it's dawah. So, you know, you're telling people either you accept Islam, and if you do, then you become part of the Islamic State, and, you know, we won't fight you, but you have to pay your zakat, which is 2.5%. But, you know, back then it wasn't just 2.5%, but it was also, you know, if you had goats, you had to give like a certain percentage of goats and certain percentage of your camels and certain percentage of this and that. So you become part of the Islamic Empire. Otherwise, you know, you have to either fight or pay the jizya. So it's considered that jihad is part of the dawah because it spreads the religion in the world. And clearly Muhammad's goal, and it's in the Quran, it's not just a hadith, it's in the Quran that, you know, fight those that until there's no more fitna and the religion is only for Allah. And, you know, the Quran talks about how liyudhirahu ala dini kulli, you know, it'll become, this religion will become manifest over all other deens, all other ways of life, right? So this religion, you know, when you have people like Salafis, it becomes easy for them to jump into jihadism because it's so clear in the Quran that the point of Islam is not just, you know, praying five times a day, and it's not just going to the mosque on Friday, but it's political in its very nature. I mean, that's how I understood it anyways. And to me, it seemed pretty clear that the religion is all about expansion. And, you know, now you have scholars like Hamza Yusuf, you know, we will say, no, we don't have to fight anymore. But like the Quran itself says these things, right? So that's, it's hard to argue that Islam is a pacifist religion. Like it's not.
It's kind of funny, like you mentioned that on his deathbed, he said, go and fight the Romans. If the Muslim narrative is correct and that Muhammad only hanged around in Medina and Mecca, since that wasn't part of the Roman.
Try that again, Abu. We lost you there.
No, I heard what he said. He was saying that it wasn't on, like, the Roman Empire was far, far away. Like, it wasn't even close to the borders of the Muslim Empire.
Yeah, I don't
yeah,
think
that's correct.
That
that's correct. Arabian, yeah, you're correct about that. I think what happened was there's a bit of a backstory to it, right? Like, there was some sort of skirmish between the Muslims and the Romans, and of course, you know, Muhammad, when he was, you know, as the story goes, and, you know, I keep saying as the story goes because I don't necessarily know how much of the stuff is really true, but this is what Muslims accept. So it's a fair and reasonable, you know, it makes sense to use these points because they believe it. And you know, that's the basis of the belief. So we can use these points. But as the story goes, in the Battle of the Trench, in the Battle of Khandaq, you know, Prophet Muhammad, you know, of course, I'm sure there's a lot of over-exaggeration to this because that's how these type of myths grow and legends, you know, myths become legends, right? So, you know, nobody could break this giant rock, right? There's this giant rock, nobody could break it. So they called Muhammad, of course, he's a superstar here, and he's like, Allahu Akbar, and he hit the rock, right? And he hit it three times, and every time he hit it, they saw a flash of lightning. And when they saw a flash of lightning, he's like, Sham will be conquered, and which is like, you know, all of Persia and Syria. And then he's like, you know, this place will be, I forget what he mentioned, but he mentioned a bunch of places, Khosra, the Persians, and then Sham, and then, so even back then, when they were like in a crisis situation, they were surrounded by enemies on every side. Muhammad was dreaming about, you know, conquering the world, right? Like, I will own this and I will own that. And so, yeah, it's pretty clear, I think.
Here is one of the verses that you were talking about. Fight them until yes. there is no more fitna. And there they translated really, and until worship is, but in Arabic it's ويكون الدين لله. So, and the religion becomes for Allah. Religion in like the religion.
Yes. And I guess I should clarify here, because I mean, that's beautiful that you actually showed that on the screen. That's awesome. I should just clarify that, you know, clearly majority of Muslims don't necessarily believe this means that we have to go as individual Muslims living in the West, let's say, as minorities, to start going and fighting individual non-Muslims or chopping off their heads or something. That's clearly not what I understood as a Muslim. My understanding was, if there's an Islamic state, Islamic government, then it would be its duty to, you know, if they needed to, then they could do jihad. Like, so this is not an individual, as I understood as a Salafi Muslim, this is not an individual commandment. This is a commandment that is on the community and on the rulers of the community. So if there's a sultan or an amir, a caliph, that he would be the one who would call for jihad. You can't have individuals calling for jihad. But then again, like anything else in religion, you can argue that. But I just wanted to make that clear, that the dominant Islamic position as to jihad,
yeah, so
it's not individuals, it's a leader.
Well, it depends on, like, there is like fardu kifaya and fardu ayn.
Yes, so exactly, fardu kifaya.
Tell us what that is, guys.
So like fardu kifaya is like enough people have to do it. So not all people. It's a bit like, okay, I can explain in this case. Like, okay, so say that Saudi Arabia would be attacked by kuffar, then it would be fardu ayn for everybody to fight the kuffar if that is what it takes to not be occupied, or whatever you call it. Mm-hmm. However, if Saudi Arabia, if the imam decides that, okay, there's a country here that are bordering us, and they are not Muslim, so we should attack them to spread the dawah. Okay, in that offensive war, it's fard kifaya, but only those men who is needed for that warfare, it's fard on them, but not for every single person.
So,
that's Islamic jurisprudence there, where basically there's certain things in Islam that some people have to do, and if somebody does it, it relieves a burden for everybody. For example, the Islamic funeral prayer, somebody has to do it. And if nobody does it, then it becomes obligatory on everybody until somebody does it. So that's the distinction he was trying to make there about Fard Kifaya and Fard Ayn. So defensive jihad is considered Fard Ayn. Everybody has to defend themselves if they're attacked, the Islamic state or empire. But like Fard Kifaya would be like, you know, as long as some people are doing jihad, then everybody's kind of free from that burden of offensive jihad. And again, like, because this is like a scholarly topic, I'm sure like Muslim scholars will go on back and forth and they'll argue about this and that. There's no real clear cut, you know, way to understand anything in religion. I mean, it's kind of like your word against mine and how you interpret things. And you know what I mean? Like, you can't say for sure one position is right and one position is wrong. And to me, one of the most clear examples of this is the moon sighting. Like when the Prophet said, Prophet Muhammad said, when you see the moon, you know, start fasting. And then when you see the moon again after 29 days, stop fasting. Now, what does that mean? See the moon. Does that mean I have to see it with my naked eye? Does that mean that someone in the community sees it? Anyone in the world sees it? And because there's no way to resolve this, because he's not here to tell us what he meant, you have all different opinions now. You have one opinion that says if you sight the moon in your locality, then you start fasting the month of Ramadan, and then again at the end you stop. The other opinion is, no, we'll go by Makkah, because Makkah is a holy city and that's what we have to go for Hajj. So we'll use their opinion. And then there's a third opinion that says we'll go by a moon sighting anywhere in the world. And then that's how we start the month. So there's actually, in my own family, I have, you know, one person who goes by local sighting, and then I have another person who goes by Saudi Arabia. And so you have different people fasting different days. Nobody even knows if Ramadan is today or tomorrow. Half of them think it started today, the other half think it starts tomorrow. And there's no way to answer this, because just like everything else in religion, it's just about like how you interpret it, what did he mean by that? And so that's the problem, right? I mean,
but that, like, but there is I would say that it's something like set theory. So you can have like the larger set of Islam, which contains all possible, like all the possible sets of Islam. But then you have, like, you can't, for example, say that Islam says that you should not fast in Ramadan. That is not within the set of it. So yes, there are ikhtilafats in like specific things, but you can like...
That's true. I would agree with that. There's definitely stronger and weaker positions in the religion. And clearly, like, some progressive Muslims want to make it sound like basically anything is allowed, right? And that obviously doesn't make sense either. So yeah, I agree with you. Set theory makes sense.
So I want to ask you something different, Abdullah, just on what you said there, to whatever degree you're open and able to chat about that. Well, what's the impact with your family? How do you know, obviously by the sounds of it, a number, if not most of them are still Muslim and you aren't, how does that work for you?
So talking about my family, we have my parents. My parents are very liberal, and honestly, that's something I'm very thankful for, is when I actually converted from the Ismaili religion to Sunni Islam back when I was 18, my mom is Sunni Muslim, like mainstream Muslim, but my dad was Ismaili, which is like this kind of heterodox sect in Islam, which many people would consider them not to be Muslims even. And I used to consider that as well when I converted. But anyways, I converted.
What is the huge difference here? Sorry, Samir, can you just quickly, just in a nutshell, explain the difference?
Yeah, sure. So Ismaili is a sect from the Shia. There's about 10 million people, maybe, if I'm getting that right, in the world. So it's not a large sect. But Ismailis follow a living imam by the name of, or by the title of, the Aga Khan. The Aga Khan literally means the King of Kings, okay? So it's a pretty, you know, like he has one of the names of God almost, right? And he's basically, he considers himself to be the descendant of Ali ibn Abi Talib, the cousin of the Prophet. So Shias, you know, they hold in esteem the 12 Imams which are basically all the relatives, all of them are relatives and descendants of Ali, you know, starting from Ali and then Hussein, and it goes down the line, right? So now Shias, they stop at number 12, Imam al-Mahdi. And Imam al-Mahdi is in a cave in Iraq hiding somewhere, right? And he's going to come out on the Day of Judgment. I think he's in a cave in Iraq. Anyway, so he's hiding in a cave and he's going to come out on the Day of Judgment. So they're waiting for Imam Mahdi to come back and to save the world, right? Now, the Ismailis, they broke off from the majority. So those are called the Twelvers, the Ithnasharis, 12ers, which means they believe in 12 Imams. And Ismaili, and that's the majority of Shias, by the way. And then Ismailis broke off from them. You know, they became Boras. That's another sect. And then from the Boras, they split and they became Ismailis. The Ismailis believe that chain has continued till this day. So till this day, the Imam, his name is Shah Karim al-Husseini. You can Google him. He lives in Switzerland. He used to be married to a model, but then they got divorced. So it's considered that Aga Khan, he is the spiritual leader of the Ismailis. And, you know, when he dies, it'll be his son and then his son. Anyways, so they've completely changed the religion. They've made it very modern. They don't pray the Salah or the Namaz anymore. They don't pray five times a day. They pray three times a day, their own prayer called the Holy Dua, which was, you know, written by Aga Khan. And they don't believe in hijab, so women don't wear hijab. They don't believe in zakat, so they don't pay zakat. They don't believe in Hajj, so they don't go for Hajj. Although some Ismailis do go for Hajj, but I don't think it's one of the tenets of Ismailism per se. Instead, what they do is they pay 1/8 of the gross income directly to Aga Khan. Okay?
So that's he gets so rich.
1/8 of all of the income of all of these 10 million Ismailis or so in the world that, you know, choose to pay it, although it's not an option. Like my dad used to tell me that when you pay this, you know, things will go well in your life. When you don't pay, things won't go well in your life. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah. So he's like, I always pay. And he used to have an envelope in his house. Every time he got paid, he would take out like $500 or whatever it was, 1/8 of his gross income, put it in an envelope, cash, and then every week he would go to the Jamaat Khana, which is a Ismaili mosque, and he would drop the envelope, cash, into the mosque, into the temple or whatever you want, Jamaat Khana. And this is one of the forms of the income. So this is Ismailism. Ismailism is we don't go by the Quran, we go by this man, Aga Khan. On top of it, they pray to Aga Khan. So it's like a pope, right? They actually, but not just that, they actually pray to him and they ask him to forgive. He's like an intercessor between them and Allah. So when I found out about this, actually, when I started reading the Quran, I was like, whoa, this goes against the Quran. The Quran says, La tushriku bi shay'a, like don't commit shirk, don't associate partners with God. Right? And then I'm like, well, this is weird because that's what Ismailis are doing. So I actually left that. That's why I say it's almost like a different religion. It's so different from Sunni Islam that I used to consider it like a different religion. So I converted from that religion to Sunni. And then, you know, when I converted, my family was very liberal. My Ismailis tend to be liberal. They integrate well in society. Like I said, they don't have any concept of jihad, anything like that. They're all about, you know, being good neighbors and doing a lot of charity and going to the mosque. It's like a very, like, modern version, watered down version of Islam, you could say, right? So what happened was I converted because when I read the Quran, I'm like, well, this doesn't match what the Quran says, and I don't want to go to hell forever because that's what God says. He's not going to forgive, you know, shirk. So I converted, but my family was very understanding. My dad was very liberal, and he's like, just however you want to pray to God, just pray to God. So, you know, I'm like, yeah, okay, this looks cool, and this Quran seems cool, and I want to be on God's good side. And I wasn't too critical about it. I just accepted it. So then that's the path I went down. At the time, my brother also converted. I have one younger brother. He followed me in my footsteps. I convinced him as well. My dad never converted. He was just like, no, you know what? Religion is about blind faith to him. He used to say, I believe blindly and that's it. It just makes sense to him. He was more like a cultural Ismaili. He wasn't exactly very religious, but he did used to believe in God a lot. So he was cool with it. My mom was cool. She doesn't care. I mean, she doesn't mind. But now the same thing when I left Islam completely, when I found out that there's problems in the Quran, it doesn't match the word of God, what God would have really said. I told my family, my mom was okay with it. She was like, yeah, it's okay. You know, you can, if you don't want to believe in God, that's fine. But I think you should believe in God because God, you know, he helps us when we need him. And I'm like, well, I don't believe that, but I don't believe anyone's out there listening. But she was like, okay, it's no problem. It's your choice. My younger brother, unfortunately, he's basically what I used to be. And he's a very strict Muslim. And, you know, he was very disappointed and very unhappy that I left Islam. And he doesn't want to talk about it with me. He doesn't want to discuss it. So I don't discuss it with him. We don't discuss it. He blocked me on Facebook. You know, he basically doesn't want to discuss it. It's just, yeah, you chose to be a disbeliever. It's your choice. Just don't bring me into it. I don't want to know why. Like, that's it, right? So that was kind of sad. And the rest of my family, they're kind of like moderate Muslims. They're not really religious. And so they were like, okay, whatever. They know I'm not Muslim and they're like, okay with it, I guess. They're disappointed. Like, my auntie started crying. And, you know, she's like, she came to my house and she's like, why are you going from one extreme to another? You were Salafi, now you're atheist, and you're just going from one extreme to another. I'm like, no, because I was following it to the full amount because that's what I believe to be true. And that's what I thought God wanted from us. Like, why wouldn't you want to be on God's good side if God is real? Would you just want to go halfway and say, I don't really care what you think, even though you created me. I don't really give a crap what you think about me. I'm just going to do what I feel like doing. No, I wanted to do it properly because I wanted to go to paradise, right? And I wanted to be a good person, and I wanted to be the best person I could be. And now I don't see the reason to believe, so I'm atheist. It's not an extreme. There's just no evidence for Islam, right? But she was crying and crying, and I was like, I started laughing, and I couldn't help it because it sounds so funny that someone's crying. It's like, you know, it's like your kids are crying because Santa Claus is not coming, right? And you might start laughing when they start crying because you find it so funny that they're actually, you know, sad that this imaginary person is not coming. Just the same reason she was crying that I'm going to go to this imaginary hell. I couldn't help but laugh because it was like, I felt sad for her. Like, you're so stuck in this thing that you actually believe I'm going to be burned alive. So, yeah, thankfully my family is very liberal, very understanding, very moderate in a sense. And for the most part, I haven't had any problems. The vast majority of Muslims are not in this situation, which is why it's so difficult for people to come out, you know? It's so difficult for people to come out because they lose their family members, they lose their wife, they lose their kids. It's just like, it's just a disaster if they come out. So I understand why people don't want to come out, right? I understand that they'll be shunned by their families, they'll be shunned by the community. And in my case, well, you know what? My family is accepting of it. My wife was okay with it eventually. So I could do it, but I understand if other people can't do it. Like, you know, stop spamming. He mentioned to me that, you know, where he lives, it, you know, it can be a danger for him to mention that. And many, many, many people I know, I'd say the vast majority, 99% of ex-Muslims I know are in the closet for that very reason.
That's a very, very, very important point that you are making there, because I always maintain, because I see reality, I see everyday life, and I see that my colleagues are not good Muslims, okay? But they will never admit it. They will run through the mosque on a Friday because it is expected of them. It's the peer pressure that they have. It's society pressures. But they're not Muslims. And this is the funny thing, and this is why there are so many atheists in Saudi Arabia, but people are not allowed to admit it because they're being labeled as terrorists. So you're raising an excellent point here, yeah.
Can I just say one more thing? The thing is, though, was this is something that really surprised me. A lot of those people that are not religious Muslims are still Muslim. And what I mean by that is cultural. I almost expected, but not just that. Like, ideologically, they still subscribe to Islam, even though they don't follow anything. And this shocked me, because when I left Islam, I have a whole bunch of friends who are, like, not religious Muslims. Like, some of my cousins, for example, like, you know, and some of my friends, they drink, and they're like almost 0% Muslim. Like, you wouldn't even know they're Muslim, except they go to a mosque once in a while. And when I told them Islam is false, and I said I found out the religion is false, I would have thought, well, they'd be like, wow, that's cool, I want to join you, right? But it wasn't like that. It was totally different. They're like, wow, I feel sad for you. I was like, what? And they're like, yeah, I used to look up to you. I wanted to be like you. You were the one I wanted to be like, and now you just left the religion. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? I'm scratching my head. And then I realized, just like those jihadi terrorists in France, that they're going to the pub, they're having a pint, and then they're going, Allahu Akbar, and they're shooting down people and ramming down people with trucks. These guys are still ideologically connected to Islam. Right? So it's weird. It's like, I could never be that type of person, because yeah, if you believe in it, you do it. You don't believe, but there's people that they're in a very weird, twisted position. And I've heard from a friend who lives in California that he got like, I never got death threats in person. All my death threats have been online, which I can kind of safely ignore. But this guy got death threats in person for something he did online. He made a video against the Prophet and his community, the Afghan community, didn't take it very well. And they all know him, right? They knew who he was in the video. Like, he actually heard from a family member that they threatened they're gonna beat the shit out of him for his video. So he delisted his video, but these are the same guys that they drink alcohol and they... So, you know, Muslims will say, yeah, see what I mean? These are just like, these are not true Muslims. They drink alcohol and they, you know, they do this and do that. And these are the guys making these threats. But that's not the point. The point is they're still motivated by Islam. They're not motivated by any other reason to hurt this guy, except their religious sensibilities were offended. And Muhammad himself did the same thing, killing people that offended him, right? Insulted him. So the problem with Muslims is they wanna strawman these people and say these guys have nothing to do with Islam. But they have everything to do with Islam, even if they're not practicing. They're still motivated by it, right? So, you know, that's the thing.
Pascal Muslim?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that like a Pascal Muslim?
Yeah, Pascal's better than Muslim?
Yeah, just in case.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much what they are. And of course, there's going to be some religious Muslims that also act that way too. And, you know, just because someone's not religious, or someone doesn't show religiosity, or someone doesn't know all of the detailed fiqhi rulings that, you know, us non-Muslims and ex-Muslims seems to know more about than those guys, it doesn't mean they're not motivated by Islam, right? Like, just because, you know, some guys that went to join ISIS had a Islam for Dummies book, does that mean they're not Muslim? No. Does that mean they're not motivated by Islam? No. They're motivated by Islam. They want to learn more. They want to teach. They probably want to give it to the new converts in ISIS, right? I mean, this is the reason. Just because they bought a book called Islam for Dummies, that doesn't mean you can say they're not Muslim, which is what, you know, moderate Muslims want to do. They want to distance themselves. You know, obviously they want to distance themselves from ISIS. So they're like saying, oh, look, they bought an Islam for Dummies book. But no, that actually shows they're motivated about Islam. They want to learn about Islam and they want to teach it to others, right? Not to mention the fact that the highest, you know, leadership positions in ISIS are like people that are fluent in Arabic and know the Quran and Sunnah inside out and can defeat any moderate Muslim in a debate on Islam. So you can't say they know it's nothing to do with Islam, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you're obviously aware of a guy called Christian Prince. What do you think of him?
Actually, no, I haven't heard of him.
Oh, okay. It'd be worth looking online. From what everybody tells me, and I listened a little bit, he's quite knowledgeable on the Quran and the Hadiths, and he goes into it quite deeply. He speaks Arabic fluently. I believe he's a Arab Christian.
Okay, I see.
And I was just listening to one of his hangouts, etc., and he had all these commenters, and they're going, yeah, the Arab Christians are the ones that know the Quran the best, because obviously they've been under pressure, and so they've gone to go and learn all of these sort of things, and they feel they are the best people to debate or challenge, you know, Muslims.
That's so true. Yeah. I've heard that as well, yeah, that the Arabic Christians know a lot about Islam. They tend to know the detailed rulings, unlike, you know, Western non-Muslims.
Yes. I like this. Have you seen this Brother Rashid channel, Al Haya? They are Christians, but they are kind of funny in Arabic.
Yes.
Yeah, so what was I going to ask you? Question just escaped me for a moment. You guys can talk for a moment. There was something I was going to ask you now. So one of the things I was going to ask you, so how is Islam seen in Canada as opposed to, for example, here in the UK? Because obviously people over here, there's some people that think it's all fine, but I get the increasing sense over here that the general public does not view Islam in a positive light in any sense. If you go and speak to a man in the street that's going to really air their views, they're not going to, you know, speak positively of Islam. What is it like there?
No, it's not like that here. Not at all. I don't think we have some of the most the problems that you guys have in UK, with like entire streets being dominated by Salafis and, you know, people going around in niqab, like very often seeing niqabis, and entire areas dominated by like Muslim shops and Muslim owners, and you know, the Sharia policing that I've heard about that kind of happens in some areas, or at least not if official policing, but they, you know, then like intimidation towards women that are dressed in a certain way. I've heard about some of these things happening in the UK. We don't have anything like that over here. For the most part, thankfully, you know, maybe because we're physically separated and we can have more control over the immigration process. We don't have a large number of niqabis here. It's quite a small minority. I'd say probably 1% to 2% of people wear niqab here. Like, you know, if I'm going out in the street, maybe once every few days, maybe once a week, maybe not even once a week, I might see someone in niqab. Muslims here are well integrated. They tend to work in good positions in society, and, you know, like in IT, and in a little bit less in banking because of the Wal Haram issue, but like the, you know, doctors and lawyers and all throughout the community. The non-Muslim community here is very tolerant, very loving, very accepting of everybody. And we haven't faced, you know, some of these issues that you guys are facing. So it's not like that. Like there are people that are kind of like hostile to Muslims, but they're kind of shunned by the majority, as far as I can tell. And if they're not shunned, like, you know, if there's like another Trump style uprising coming up in Canada, like, I'm not aware of it because I'm not in those groups per se. And I'm not, you know, I don't associate myself with those type of people per se. So I wouldn't even really know, because like the whole Trump thing, the whole populist government, you know, the whole xenophobia, the whole Brexit, all that stuff, I don't think even liberals even saw it coming. It just came all of a sudden, right? Out of the blue. So I think there's a little bit of a communication gap between the left and right. And you know, in general, us humans, we tend to want to surround ourselves with like-minded individuals. We don't want to step outside of the echo chamber or the bubbles. And so sometimes it just creeps up on you. I mean, there was a big kerfuffle with the wall, C-17 or whatever, the wall condemning Islamophobia motion. And, you know, a lot of people went completely nuts, especially the Christian right. They went completely nuts over this motion. So first of all, people thought it was a law condemning Islamophobia, meaning like anyone that criticizes Islam can go to jail. And of course, I would be up in arms. Everybody should be up in arms as to any sort of, you know, policing on free thought and the ability to have a difference of opinion on. But the ex-Muslim community, for the most part, from what I can tell, was okay with the thing, because it was mainly condemning Islamophobia in the sense of anti-Muslim bigotry. The wording of the bill, it shouldn't have the motion. Sorry, it wasn't a bill, it was a motion. Was it a motion? Yeah, it was a motion, not a bill. So it was just a motion to condemn Islamophobia, because there was like three guys that got killed in a mosque. some guy went inside the mosque and shot them up. So, you know, because of that, they made this motion, and it was, honestly speaking, it was nothing. It was just it was just condemning what happened, and you know, condemning any sort of hate speech against Muslims, which I'm against hate speech against Muslims too, right? I'm all for criticizing Islam, but not to demonize this particular group. And you know, sometimes that can be challenging, because where do you draw the line, especially when that group has certain problematic characteristics and values that go against, you know, let's say your more tolerant values of bigger of the larger society, right? So it can be challenging, but I am against anti-Muslim bigotry. But I'm not against, I hate that word, Islamophobia, because it conflates anti-Muslim bigotry with criticism of Islam. And Islam deserves to be criticized or critiqued or whatever, because it's an idea, right? It's just like anything else, any other idea, right?
So what would
Well, can I ask, are you in Canada or in the US?
I'm in Canada.
Okay.
What would you consider anti-Muslim bigotry or quote hate speech? What would that be for you?
So an example of that would be like trying to make it seem that the Muslim community is a bunch of rapists or a bunch of like jihadists that want to go and kill everybody, or to say that
we've lost you. Either you've dropped or you're muted.
Are like, you know, did I get cut off for a second?
Your signal just dropped. So just repeat what you said there after you said,
Don't
try to demonize the community.
The point I was trying to make was to try to like make it seem, because, you know, obviously there's some kind of bad ideas in the Muslim community, you know, anti-women sometimes, or, you know, most Muslims are against homosexuality or whatever, but trying to scaremonger and Muslims are like, you know, like ready to like, you know, burst into like action and chop off people's heads or something, or they need to be put in jail. Like, there's a page online which someone, an ex-Muslim I know, was actually following, that was like trying to say like, you know, Muslims are a bunch of rapists and they're here to take our jobs and this and that, and you know, we should, like, this page was actually calling for like putting Muslims in jail, like all Muslims. Like, I was shocked, right? When I'm like this is crazy. Like, not all Muslims are the same. Not all people follow Islam the same way. The majority of people I know, anyways, in Canada, they're very moderate in the sense of they don't do half the stuff or believe half the stuff. They're probably against Sharia just like I am, but they still subscribe to Islam, and somehow they convince themselves that they can do that, which I would disagree with. But
yeah,
that's what I consider anti-Muslim bigotry.
Yes, so I would agree. So you'd consider that a bit like the KKK, but again, most critics, as you're probably aware, most critics that have got some self-respect and integrity never say all Muslims or the entire community. I would always say some Muslims or a majority or a subset, or depending on what I'm talking about. And I think most would say say the same. So anybody who says all Muslims, clearly I think we would all agree they just don't know all Muslims. So where you could generalize where you say all Muslims believe in Muhammad. I mean, that's clearly a true statement.
Yes,
but further than that, you'd have to sort of subdivide them, because not all Muslims believe will follow Muhammad's example, or they will cherry pick parts of the example, or they will make it sound different. And so, you know, from there on down, basically, you know, all Muslims are not the same.
And I do think, and I do feel that the Muslim community is reforming itself, as hard as it is to reform Islam, because Islam is perfect and all that nonsense. The Muslim community is making changes, and the way they're doing it is in a funny way. Like, the way they're doing it is because they can't like officially come out and say, oh, I'm, you know, Islam is bad, so I want to change it. So what they're doing is they're trying to reinterpret the text in a way that's more in line with like modern secular values. For example, you know, there's like a bunch of people now trying to say that Aisha wasn't 6 when she got married and 9 when the marriage was consummated. It's like, oh yeah, she's 18, right? And you're like, you're laughing because, well, first of all, nobody had an issue with her being a little girl all this time. And second of all, it just doesn't fit with the narratives, right? With the hadith literature and with the story, and it doesn't fit. But that's kind of like the way they're reforming it. And then you have people like Hamza Yusuf, and so there's kind of like a split in the community, in the Sunni community. There's Sufis and then there's Salafis. By Sufis, I don't mean only Sufis, but basically anybody that follows a madhab. They call themselves traditional Muslims, that's just the word they came up with, and they may have different names for it. And to counter that, you have the Salafis, who basically, they don't go by any madhab, any school of thought, like, you know, Hanafi, Shafi, Hanbali, or Maliki, for the most part, they just directly interpret the Quran and Sunnah, and then that's how you have Wahhabism, you know, Ibn Taymiyyah, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. So there's kind of two factions. The Salafi community are the ones that they want to stick directly black and white to the texts. And these are the guys who are the most dangerous in the world and the worst for the world, because they don't care how good it sounds or how bad it sounds. The Prophet said, you got to kill apostates. We got to kill apostates. You guys and your kuffar laws, you just want to be like the kuffar. You just want to please the kuffar. You don't want to kill the apostates. But the Prophet said, you know, if he changes his religion, kill him. Like, that's how they are, right? Then you have the Sufis, or like I said, the whatever they want to call themselves, traditional Muslims. They have this body of text behind them that goes for 1400 years. And they have this scholarly chains of narration. So they have this. So basically, the non-Salafis, the let's call them Sufis, for lack of a better term, the traditionalists, they have reformed Islam already, and they're continuing to do it because they appeal to authority, right? So like Hamza Yusuf, for example, even like say Omar Suleiman, he has a video, 2-hour or 3-hour video, on slavery, right? And he goes on, and I was watching this video because a friend sent it to me, and he's like, you can't sleep with a slave if she's married. You can't separate a husband and wife slave. You have to ask her for permission before you fuck her. And I'm like, what? Like, where did all this come from, right? And he didn't use that word, but anyways, I apologize. I was getting carried away. So I'm like, where did all these rules come from? I've never heard any of this before, right? And of course, he didn't come up with any basis for it, but like, there's a whole bunch of Islamic fiqh rulings that have been kind of built up over the years, and they always have to somehow tie it back to what Muhammad said. But like, honestly speaking, it is reformed in a sense. Like, of course, they still believe that, you know, like homosexuals should be killed if you have four witnesses and of intercourse and all that, and adulterers. However, they will probably say we don't need to implement that today. Like Hamza Yusuf has actually come out and said, I would not apply hudud punishments in today's world because the world is so different than the world that the Prophet used to be in. So he'll outright say it. And because of that, ISIS will say he's a kafir. Look, he's rejecting the commands of Allah. He's not ruling by the commands of Allah, as the Quran says. So he's an apostate. He's a murtad. He should be killed. So of course, there's going to be like a conflict between these ultra Salafis and these, you know, as they call themselves, or traditionalists, even though they're kind of reforming the religion. But I do think the Muslim community is slowly reforming, because, you know, putting these things in the limelight, they're kind of troubling. Not kind of, they're quite troubling, right? Some of these traditional Islamic values. So I think that's how the reform is happening.
Yeah, I think a lot of this would go away.
Quran 4:24 allows a man to have sex with a married slave. It's in the Quran 4:24.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, how do they justify this? I don't know. Like, I don't even know what the basis is for these so-called rules about you can't sleep with a married slave. And yeah, it doesn't make sense. I agree with you. I don't know where it's coming from.
And the problem with this is all to make it appear, like you say, more acceptable to Western civilization. All they really need to do, they don't need to go through all these hoops. All they need to do is say, do you know what? The Quran and Muhammad were the 7th century. We've moved on from there. So whatever happened then, yeah, it's not great. We wouldn't do that today. And it was for the 7th century. End of problems. But of course, they can't do this.
Yeah.
That would just solve something on Islamophobia. My favorite thing is always to go and say, well, we know what Islam is. This is the political ideology, but a phobia is a malfunction of the brain. So Islamophobia would be that Islam is a malfunction of the brain. I don't think you want that.
But is it always a malfunction? I mean, there are phobias that are very beneficial from an evolutionary perspective. So like,
phobia is always something, it's an irrational fear.
Yeah, but if you have a phobia against snakes, for example, is that...
No. The justified hesitancy or something that is that you sense danger or there's a phobia. In other words, if you see anything that resembles a snake, then you suddenly start running away or you start screaming or you start acting irrationally. That's the difference.
Well, that's the thing, right? They're using Islamophobia as a slur. They're saying, oh, you guys are allergic to Islam. You're Islamophobes, because what they're trying to say is that you have an irrational fear of Islamic law. But the reality is, it's not irrational. If I was in a Muslim country, I would be dead. So is it irrational?
No, but I make fun of, exactly what I used to make fun of, but it's a malfunction of the brain. So are you telling me that Islam is a malfunction of the brain? And this then gets them into a spin because they don't understand what they're just doing.
And whenever I challenge them in the park, of course, and point out that no Muslim country is where most of us would want to live, maybe they do, but I don't even think they would, then the response is always, well, they're just not implementing it correctly. If they just did it, quote, my way or, quote, the proper way, then we'd have a great society.
Yeah, it's a no true Scotsman fallacy again, right? If only everyone would wake up for Fajr, then Palestine would conquer Israel and, you know, the world would be different and this and that and all that nonsense. But like another thing about Islamophobia, if Islamophobia exists, then shouldn't Islamophilia exist as well? Yeah, like, you know, like pedophilia? Islamophilia.
Yeah, somebody has.
And by the way, in Malaysia, for example, while we're on this, do you know that they have prohibited the tradition of waking up people 3 o'clock in the morning during Ramadan? Because they used to run through the streets and make a lot of noise to wake everybody up so that you can eat before then the sun comes up. And now they've stopped it. So this is also a form of reform.
Yeah. I didn't know about that. I don't know if that's not actually part of the religion per se, but that's a cultural practice that has appeared.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
This is how it gets implemented. Ace, and eat. Yeah, I'm sure Ace can.
It's a pida.
It's a pida. In Egypt, they have suhoor drums. They go drumming to the street, and people give them donations because that's how the society kind of sticks together.
Limited time, Abdullah. So I want to just get a question, and it's been waiting. Somebody asked a question. It was more of a statement, and you can comment. Abdullah, and he's not actually a Muslim, I don't think, but he says, Abdullah, I strongly disagree with you using Quran 53:2-12 as Quranic justification for the validity of Hadith, when only a few lines down, there are now edited satanic verses. 2-12 is Muhammad making excuses.
Okay. The same fellow actually left a comment on my YouTube as well. Okay. I'm guessing he's a Quranist and he's against Hadith. So that's another way of reforming Islam, is to edit out the Hadith and, you know, make the Quran have no context anymore. I don't really care like about whether Hadith is justified or not. The reason I use Hadith to discuss with Sunni Muslims is because that's what I used to believe, and they believe it's justified. I don't really need to justify whether Hadith is. I mean, if you don't believe in Hadith, all the power to you, my friend. That's what I'll say.
But then, of course, many of the things that a certain number of Muslims take, you know, is not to be found in the Quran, like the number of times you pray, etc. And Stops has mentioned this many times. So if you ditch the Hadith, then many of your day-to-day things, if you are, you know, fairly staunch practicing Muslim, don't have a foundation.
Exactly. Yeah. So I like I said, the way I was following Islam, I felt like Hadith was an integral part of the religion. But if people don't want to follow the Hadith, they only want to follow the Quran, does that mean now suddenly the Quran is a word of God and it's miraculous? I haven't been able to be convinced by anybody that doesn't believe in Hadith that the Quran has a solid basis for belief in it. So, I mean, it's up to you. If you want to believe in the Quran by itself, all the power to you. I personally don't think that's what Islam is supposed to be. But hey, maybe you're right and maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
So final question, because I know you have to go and I want to respect your time. What do you say, because we've had a chat about this recently, but what would be your thought on the way to approach people and have a conversation to get them A, thinking, B, maybe critical thinking, or maybe considering whether Islam is in fact true? What would be what is your approach, or what have you found to be effective when you speak to Muslims?
Right. So this is something that I feel like you can't kind of convince people, and people that are open-minded and willing to dialogue are people that are open-minded, and people that are not, like, you know, people come and they want to talk to you sometimes, and the only reason they're talking to you is just to convince you. They're actually not interested in being convinced or in reconsidering the position. So I try my best. Like I did have a discussion with a friend who I hadn't seen in many, many years, and this guy was a big influence on me as a Muslim, and he's someone I looked up to a lot, like a Bengali friend of mine. And I asked him, I said, like, I don't see any reason to believe in the Quran. And he was like, yeah, but that's your choice. You know, people choose if they want to believe in God or not. And people choose if they want to follow the religion of God. And I'm like, well, hold on a second. Are you telling me there's no rational basis to believe in the Quran? Is that what you're saying? He's like, no, I'm not saying that. He's like, I'm saying that, you know, you have to choose it, right? I'm like, okay, fine. So then if that's the case, right, then let's say two people come to you. And, you know, I think you have to just kind of think it through, right? And street epistemology is one way of kind of getting people, this is where I learned it from, you know, getting people to kind of think about it a little bit more and like asking them like, well, if two people came to you, one of them was, and I'm sure you're well aware of this, Rob, because you're on Speaker's Corner, and you know, one guy's a Hindu, one guy's a Muslim, and both of them come to you and say, well, this book is from God. How do you know which is the true one? And then I said, well, isn't it true that the very basis for believing in God, like him sending a book, by its very nature is something that you can be completely fooled by? Meaning, someone can completely lie to you and say this book is from God, and you'd have to investigate it to know, right? Because how else would you know if the method of delivery is someone telling you, well, then God's actually given us a method that's very flawed in the sense of like, you have to investigate it, right? You can't just know just from the fact that the guy told you. So I think kind of thinking through these kind of things and kind of discussing in that sense, not, you know, my mistake is I used to tell people, this is my mistake. People used to ask me, let's have a talk. And I'd be like, okay. And then they'd be like, why you don't believe, right? And I'd be like, well, yeah, this Quran is wrong on this and wrong on this and wrong on this. And I just give them a bunch of reasons why the Quran's wrong. And they're like, okay, bye. And that was the end of it. But now I don't do that anymore. I'd rather ask them to explain to me why they believe in the Quran. And then that actually has, you end up having a much better conversation, because then you can try to understand where they're coming from. And you can put the burden of proof on them, and they can explain to you, well, the Quran is amazing because of so. And you're like, okay, yeah, but what about this? And then, you know, you have a much better conversation. Sometimes yeah. They get pissed off, though, when you do that. If you tell them, like, you know, it happens sometimes. People say, you tell me why you don't believe. And you'll be like, well, you tell me why you believe. And like, hey, that's not fair. You're asking a question to a question. You answer first, right? They think like you're trying to trick them or something, but it's not a trick. Like it's like serious. It's like, you tell me why you believe and let's discuss that, right?
I mean, you can always throw it back. So what you could do if you don't want to, and Stops is obviously quite solid on that point, is so you just say there's no good reasons and evidence. Can you provide me some? So you've given an answer, but you've like asked the question in your answer. And now they have to provide it, because that way, because otherwise, yes, they're going to feel like you're not prepared to answer a question. Hey, I've answered your question. No good reasons and evidence. Can you provide me some? Boom. Now the ball's back in their court.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah. I do want to respect your time. Thank you again so much. I know you've got to go back to work, so I appreciate it. We'll try and do one where we can have you on for 2 hours. We can have a much longer chat, or if you're doing another one, we're happy to come on at different times of the day. So, again, it's great to hear from you. I hope you keep well. Thank you for your time, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again soon.
All right. Thank you so much. Well, I'll be in touch. Hey, guys, it was wonderful, Abu and Stops and Rob. Thanks for having me again. I do enjoy these discussions. I think it's quite fantastic when you have, you know, like-minded people together and be able to kind of discuss some of the things that are going on in the community and the world and, you know, why people believe and don't believe. I think this is a fantastic thing to do. So keep it up. Keep up the good work. And I'll catch you guys maybe next week or something.
Yep, try to sounds do this again. Great. Thanks so much.
Brilliant.
Okay. All the best, guys.
And remind me to ask him one thing next time. Did he ever or has he ever regretted going public? Because this is an interesting question, I think.
You know what? I can answer you right now. I'm not in a... Yeah. I'm still here. Okay, so have I ever regretted going public?
Yes.
Okay, so the answer is, okay, but here's the thing. The one thing I wish I could have done differently, and this is what one of my friends is doing now, is I kind of wish I could have talked to at least my brother one-on-one before going public, because I would have had a much better chance of being able to reach him. Although, frankly speaking, based on his personality and his world, like, I don't want to talk about a thing. I have a feeling he wouldn't have discussed with me even then. He would have probably just said, go talk to a sheikh, which is what he told me to do. He told me, go talk to the imam. And that was it. He didn't want to involve himself, which is kind of sad, because he became Muslim because of me. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm the one that led him to Islam. So how is it that you can have an open mind and go to Islam, yet you shut your mind down when you become Muslim? And you say, now I'm done thinking. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's ironic that the very open-mindedness that you had that brought you to the religion, you just throw that in the garbage. And now you say, okay, now I'm done. This is a final decision I made now for the rest of my life, no matter what evidence comes to me. So that was kind of sad to me. But other than that, you know, before I made the videos, I had the blog, and the blog was there, and nobody threatened me. It's only when I made the videos that people started threatening me. So clearly the videos are more of a threat, I guess, to the some people in the Muslim community. So that's the only thing, right? But I don't regret it one single bit. I'm just trying to keep my head up. You know, I think the more people that come public and the more people that can come out as public ex-Muslims, I feel like even more people will do so, and even more people will do so. You can't kill everybody. You know what I mean? You can't threaten everybody, and you can't shut up everybody if people keep standing up and saying, no, I'm not going to be intimidated. I don't care about, you know, your stupid religion trying to threaten me. I'm going to do what's right for the world. And, you know, frankly, there's going to come a point in time where I don't need to talk about Islam anymore. And you know what? I'll talk about something else that's like more interesting, you know, science or philosophy or music or something that actually, you know, matters more than just religious, you know, just religious thing, religious nonsense that, you know, I really do want to move on past the whole, you know, talking about religion thing. You know, I thought about, should I do like a master's or should I study, you know, Islam? And I'm like, why would I want to waste more time on this religion I've already wasted? You know what, people that are open-minded, they're going to believe me or they're going to think about what I'm saying. People that are closed-minded, they don't care anyways. Even if I had a PhD, they still wouldn't care. You know, it's not going to make a difference to them. So I'm actually trying to study philosophy and learn, you know, something useful, right? Something that'll help me in my thinking process and all that. So stops. No, I don't regret it one single bit. It could have been much worse. Like I said, my wife could have left me. That was one thing I was kind of worried about in the beginning. I wasn't sure how she would balance the whole Islamic ruling of, you know, she's not allowed to be with a non-Muslim man versus, you know, destroying her entire family over this religion, right? So many people I know, the wife decided to break up with them, right? So unfortunately, it could have gone the other way, but it's just my personality. You know, like if you remember last time we talked about free will, I truly believe the way I am, because of my genetics, because of my environment, because of my upbringing and my experiences in life, led me to be the open person that I am. And I think, unfortunately, the sad reality is, even if my wife would have left me, I don't think I could have kept quiet, because I feel like people need to know. I spent like a huge chunk of my life on this thing, right? And I don't want other people to do the same if it's not true. Like I don't want another person to waste their entire life, you know, every decision they make in their life, every thought that you have, you know, even when you're walking, you have to think, do I like, a funny example is, let's say you're like, you know, you're about to pray or you said your prayers or something, and before you pray, you have to wash, right? But like, if you fart, then you lose your wudu and you have to wash again before you can pray. So as a Muslim, you got to be even thinking before you fart, like, can I fart right now or do I have to pray first? Right? So it's like every single thing, you know, in your life has to be, you have to look at it from the perspective of Islam, and that's a huge cost, right? Like, can I fight or not? Even that, to that level, right? So it's like, you know, it's so sad. Like, I had a friend email me, and it's like, remember that blog you had? And he's like, I know we haven't talked to you in a long time, and I know you're not Muslim anymore, but you posted on your blog that Bitcoin is halal, you know, because of this and this and this. And he's like, can you please remove it? Because I emailed the sheikh, you know, this guy was feeling guilty that he was involved in Bitcoin, which is this digital currency that came out. And he emailed the sheikh, and the sheikh was like, he's like, sheikh, you know, my friend, he put your fatwa online that you said Bitcoin looks like it might be legit. And do you agree with this? And the sheikh was like, no, because Bitcoin is not accepted as a currency by any government yet. So according to the sheikh, he would consider halal if like the Japanese government or the whatever, some government decided to allow it. Like, it's such a ridiculous thing.
Yeah, that just makes stuff up as they go along. In parting, I would say to you, Abdullah, keep doing what you're doing, because I think you're the voice for many of those quiet Muslims who wish they could come out and they couldn't. So I appreciate you want to move on, but I think sometimes people like yourselves are the voice that many people out there in the world who are frightened, who are in situations that the only dream they could be in your situation wish. And so you are saying what they are thinking. And so from that perspective, you are the most important people out there, because the Sam Harris's, Richard Dawkins, and myself and other people who are critics are not going to be taken this seriously. But people like you, I think, are the people that will make the change. And, you know, I hope that you'll keep doing in whatever way, to the big degree or not, but you are a voice for those that don't have it.
He's a Zionist being paid to make Islam look bad.
Okay, now that I'm caught, I have to go. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I also want to add this, that I also kind of get feeling like to argue against Islam is a bit like arguing against the slowest kid in the class. But in a one way, so I'm more interested in science, I'm more interested in philosophy and things like that, and even technology. But the thing is, if you think about making a cost-benefit analysis, what's the best way, use of your time? If you think about how many Muslims there are in the world, and how much progress you can do just by deconverting a huge number of Muslims, arguing against Islam is probably one of the most time-efficient, ways you can spend your time.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And I do agree with you, and this is why I'm going to keep doing it. And again, thank you guys so much. And hopefully next week or a week after, I'll be on the channel again.
Thanks a lot again. Take care, Abdullah.
Take care. Bye.
Great stuff. It's always good to have something on. So those are the people, you know, because potential Muslims want you to leave. They might get to think from an Harris or a Dawkins or a whoever it might be, but the ex-Muslims, I think, are the real strength there, that especially those ones that know it, that were really in it deeply and can answer those questions, and that's where the doubt comes in, and that's where I think there's a voice for those people who silently wish they could make a change or have but can't say it. And so that's where Abdullah and obviously yourself, Abu, and many others are extremely valuable.